Here at The One Thing, we are passionate about getting our principles, our tools, our ideas, our training out to the world. And to do this, we have to create a lot of content. And so we need a powerful platform that can help us manage this content, create courses and podcasts and memberships. And that's why for many years now, we've been using Kajabi. Kajabi is the ultimate all-in-one platform that helps creators and entrepreneurs build successful online businesses by unlocking predictable, reoccurring revenue. So if you're a creator and you work hard on creating content, don't leave it up to an algorithm to determine how successful your online business will be. Look to Kajabi. No matter your niche, Kajabi makes it easy to turn your skills, passions, and experiences into enriching online courses, exclusive membership sites, subscription podcasts, thriving communities, personalized coaching, and more. And the best part? Kajabi doesn't take a cut of your revenue because everything is owned and controlled by you, so you keep 100% of what you earn. Right now, Kajabi is offering a free 30-day trial to start your business if you go up to kajabi.com/one. That's kajabi.com/one. Go to kajabi.com/one and join the creators and entrepreneurs who have made over $7 billion.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the One Thing podcast. I am personally so incredibly excited to have Dr. James Doty here. He's an inventor, an entrepreneur, a philanthropist, a neurosurgeon who has been on the faculty of Stanford University School of Medicine since 1997 in the neurosurgery department as a professor. He's a New York Times bestselling author of Into the Magic Shop and here to talk to us today about his newest book, Mind Magic. Welcome, James. We're so thrilled to have you.
Well, it's wonderful to be here, and thank you for having me. I appreciate it. And also, thank you for the kind words about Into the Magic Shop. You know, it's amazing. I think that book came out in 2015, and not only was it a New York Times bestseller, it's been a bestseller in 8 countries, and which is quite amazing, 36 languages. And actually, what is most amazing, at least according to younger people, is that the Korean pop music band BTS used it as the basis for their 3rd album, and there's a song called Magic Shop. So
cool.
That's actually my only claim to fame in some parts of the world.
I was just about to say, Dave, in of all the incredible accomplishments that you list on your very impressive resume, did you ever think that that one would be on there?
No. But listen, I'm thankful, and you know, they're an interesting band because they're so thoughtful. They care about people's mental health. They're very supportive. And pretty much everything they do is around trying to help people navigate in an incredibly challenging world at this point in time.
Yeah, very much so. I told James before we hopped on, and I was telling Chris earlier today, I was like, I am so excited for this interview because I thought it was about 10 years ago that I read Into the Magic Shop. So almost 10 years. That I read Into the Magic Shop, and it was at a stage of my life where I feel like that's when the manifestation conversation really started, when it got popularized. Mm. And I always sort of perceived it to be like a little bit woo-woo and it's not real and you get what you want by working hard. And I feel like I owe a debt to you, James, because your book really did change my life. I don't say that flippantly. It truly changed my life and changed my perspective on manifestation and the scientific and medical approach that you take to it is just such an interesting read. So I'd encourage everyone to pick that one up, but that's not what we're here to talk about today. What we're here to talk about is Mind Magic, which I was just telling him, I can't wait to get my hands on because I'm sure I'll love it as much as I did Into the Magic Shop. Can you tell us a little bit about the book and what brought this one on?
Actually, it's interesting, and maybe it's true of anyone who writes a book, because the first book, one, obviously covers sort of my growing up, my challenging childhood, but also my life as a neurosurgeon in part, but it also includes meditation and what we call contemplative practice, and then it also includes neuroscience. And it's always fascinating because there's a subset of people who say, you know, I bought this book and I thought you'd talk more about neurosurgery. Then there's another group who bought it and go, I thought this was going to talk about meditation. Then there's another group. So it's sort of funny how what resonates with people. But one part of the book discusses mindfulness and how I learned the practice, but specific to this conversation, manifestation. And maybe I should just back up a little bit and give some of the listeners a bit about my background. I grew up in very challenging circumstances in Lancaster, California. And my father was an alcoholic. My mother had a stroke when I was a child, was partially paralyzed, had a seizure disorder, and unfortunately chronically depressed, which resulted in her attempting suicide multiple times. We were on public assistance, were evicted from different residences. So, of course, this is not the childhood that any of us would sign up for necessarily. But at the age of 12, I was feeling a sense of hopelessness and despair. And I ended up, after my parents got into an argument, I got on my bicycle and rode my bicycle as far and as fast as way as possible so I didn't have to deal with that. But I ended up at a strip mall where there was a magic shop, and I'd had an interest in magic. But long story short, I walked in. And I'm sure you have met people who their very presence is this radiance about them, and they have a smile that just engulfs you, and they're kind, they're thoughtful. And this is the way this lady was. And we began talking, and it turned out she knew nothing about magic. In fact, she was the owner's mother, and she was minding the store, if you will, while he ran an errand. But this conversation continued on. And one of the reasons it continued on was because she created an environment of what we call psychological safety. And I felt very comfortable with her. I didn't feel she was looking down at me. I felt that she was really interested in what I had to say. And so I opened up to her, and she actually asked some questions which normally, to be honest with you, I would not have answered. But I did in this case. And after about 15 or 20 minutes, she said to me, she said, you know, I really like you. I think I could teach you something that could really help you. And I'm here for another 6 weeks. And if you come every day, I'll spend time with you. And it turned out she taught me what is now known as a mindfulness practice. And I didn't realize at the time that my experience at home was essentially living in a war zone, completely chaotic, completely unpredictable, never knew what was going to happen. And as a result, my muscles were tense and I could never focus because I never knew what was going to happen next. So she taught me a technique to do a body survey or relax the body, a technique that allowed me to focus. And then also one, which was a self-compassion technique because I was very critical towards myself. And what I realized was that when an individual is critical of themselves, they're so often hypercritical of others. But usually we're more critical of ourselves than anyone else. But long story short, she taught me this practice. It changed my view of the world. It made me see that everyone is suffering. And then she taught me something else that was really critical, and that's about what we're talking about today, which was a manifestation technique. And of course, I was young at that time, but as you know, this idea of manifestation has been put into the context of woo-woo and pseudoscience. And people give these flowering discussions about the law of attraction and how the universe is going to intervene, and you just ask for it, and it's going to happen. And part of the problem with that is that when we look outside ourselves to create, quote unquote, the perfect life or make us happy, unfortunately, it's extraordinarily disappointing. And what I found that I did was I did make a list of all the things I wanted, but they were all about me. And unfortunately, this is the narrative of The Secret, which became so popular. Mm. What do you want? Well, I want to live in a big mansion. I want to live in a in this beautiful place. I want a Porsche or Mercedes or whatever. And then if you just think about that and over, it's magically going to happen. Well, there are several problems with that. Actually, the first sentence of the book says, the universe doesn't give a fuck about you.
Love that.
And, and the reality is because the universe has no fuck to give. Mm-hmm. And what's unfortunate is, especially in Western capitalist society, there is this narrative that success which translates into money, power, and position, therefore equals happiness. And that's what I chased after. And she had me actually make a list. And sadly, although not surprisingly, at the age of 12, I said, I want to live in a mansion. I want a Porsche. I had a friend's father who had a Rolex. I was very impressed with that. I said, I want a Rolex, et cetera, et cetera. And I actually got all of those things. But the problem was that it was all about getting external affirmation that I was okay, that somehow if I did these things, that people would tell me how great I was, the emptiness or insecurity or the shame that I had would magically go away and I would be incredibly happy. And, you know, here I was having all of these things. I had a home overlooking the ocean in Newport Beach. I had a penthouse in San Francisco. I had a Porsche, Ferrari, a BMW, a Range Rover, a Mercedes. I had this private garage in this building in San Francisco that, you know, had its own private elevator to my penthouse. I had a villa in Florence. I was flying around in private jets. I was single at the time. I was dating beautiful women. And shockingly, even though all my friends told me how fortunate I was and how great I was never more miserable in my entire life. And the reason was because it was all about me. And the problem is when it's all about you and you think in those terms, it's because you have an emptiness or an insecurity or a fear. And the problem with that is that when you're carrying that, your brain networks, which are necessary to interact, don't function as well because we function best when we feel safe, when we feel comfortable with ourselves. And what happens is this shifts you from engaging the sympathetic nervous system, which of course you know is associated with the flight, fight, or fear response, to engagement of the parasympathetic nervous system, which is where you feel safe, where you feel open. And also it's the place where you have access to different brain networks. And specifically one is your executive control function, which has access to memory experiences. And that's also associated with increased productivity and creativity. But anyway, when you're able to shift over to engagement of your parasympathetic nervous system, everything works better. Now, I can see I'm continuing to talk. You probably have some questions.
I'd love to.
Chris. Yeah. I was just saying you could keep talking and I'd be perfectly happy here,
well,
James.
I do want to start. I wanted to ask you about this, so I'm glad you brought it up because you opened the book with this. We're going to put our production team to work early with some editing, but the universe doesn't give a fuck about you. And I think there's so much power in that statement. If you're open to digging in a little bit on that, I think there's a lot there. Because what I take away from that is if you zoom out enough, like nothing really matters. Like a little Carl Sagan pale blue dot kind of perspective of like, hey, look, like this, the universe doesn't have any to give in the first place. And I know that they're like the natural response you see or maybe some feel right away is like the ego and the connection to some like divine intervention or something that's out there, some dumb luck, whatever you have to. But what I feel is that there you have to kind of let go to grab back on. And like you have to first let go. And then there, when you do, what I feel is that there's like extreme authorship then in what you can create. And I'm curious if I'm getting the right message from the premise there.
No, Chris, you're completely wrong. No. No, actually, that's exactly right. And it's interesting you put it in that terminology because, again, people think they're oftentimes, if they make something out there happy, their life will all of a sudden be perfect and they'll get everything they want. And it just doesn't work that way. It's funny, I was having a conversation with John Hamm, the actor, recently. Mm. And he said, at best, the universe is indifferent, which is probably true.
Yeah.
But getting back to what you said, Chris, was when people look outside of themselves for either happiness or satisfaction or actually making something happen in their lives, it doesn't work because people forget the immense amount of power you have within yourself to manifest. And this has nothing to do with woo-woo. It has nothing to do with pseudoscience. That's not to say that some of the principles that have been promoted can be helpful. Mm. But the problem is when it is a self-absorbing or self-absorbed narrative about what I want, it diminishes the likelihood of you getting those things. And it also hurts you. And what I mean by that is when people are constantly focused on what I want or how important they are or how their ego drives them, it actually separates them from others. And we know as a species, we evolved to connect and to care for others. And in fact, if you look at our evolution as a species, we're one of the few mammals that doesn't run off into the jungle or the forest or swim away. We have to care for our offspring for well over a decade, and that requires time and resources. So we have actually been given a genetic imperative that drives us to care. And that, what is that? One, you're rewarded. You're rewarded by the release of certain neurotransmitters, and one that I'm sure everyone has probably heard of is oxytocin. And when this is released into your brain, it stimulates your reward and pleasure centers. So that drives you to care. And it drives you to care, you know, if your child is hungry, if they're in pain, if they're cold, whatever it is, you are driven to help them. And that is the underlying reality of our existence as a species. And so when it's a self-centered sort of perspective, these things that kick in when you care, such as the parasympathetic nervous system, actually is shut down. And in fact, mm-hmm. your executive control areas, which allow you to make thoughtful decisions, doesn't work as effectively. You're not as creative. You're not as productive. And the reason that gets important here is because every time you make a negative comment about yourself, it's as if you're placing a brick and building a wall, which gets higher and darker. You are creating your own prison. If you're able to change your perspective and look outside of yourself and look at others and how you can be of service, that actually makes your brain centers work their best. That kicks in the parasympathetic nervous system. And it's incredibly important because, one, there's a difference between what a young person and even an older person thinks they want versus what they need. If you're looking through the lens of I, you get into this narrative, well, I need a big house to impress people because then people will like me. I need a fancy sports car so people will look at me. And sadly, there are a lot of people in our society who believe this narrative. And there are a lot of people who have centered their lives around this narrative. And it's sad to watch because they think that they'll get some sort of external affirmation from people who want to be like them. And that's what they live for. Yet they're some of the most saddest, unhappy people in the world. And I've known many of these people. Now, that's not to say that there is anything wrong with living a good life in the context of having things. But if having things is the sole driver of your behavior, you are ultimately going to be very happy. Now, I mentioned brain networks. So there are basically four brain networks that are critically important to us manifesting. And one of those is what we call our default mode network. And this is what happens when our mind wanders, and it's related to our self-referential identity and also determining what we want. But the critical part of that are three others. One is what we call the salience network. The other is the attention network. And then the last one is the executive control network. And these are typically called the latter three, the task positive networks. Because when they work in conjunction, what happens is if you want to manifest something, it has to get into your subconscious. Now, all of us are manifesting every day, right? We say, I want this, I want that. But we're like a person who it's their first day and in the weight room and they want to lift 500 pounds, mm-hmm. right? You know, you may go up there and try and lift, but if you don't know how to do it, if you haven't been trained, if you don't have the self-awareness and insight, you're going to fail or you're not going to do it very efficiently and potentially you're going to hurt yourself. And the point of this is that being guided to understand how you embed your intention and what your mindset has to be are the critical components that are necessary to maximize your potential to manifest. Now, that's not to say you can't or it's impossible to manifest otherwise. I mean, here I was.
One habit that my wife and I are really proud of that we put in place over the last couple of years is a monthly budget review. Getting on the same page about how we're investing and spending has been a game changer for us. Whether you're budgeting by yourself or you're financial planning with another, it can be tedious. You're pulling together multiple sources of information, updating multiple spreadsheets, but the good news is it doesn't have to be that difficult. That's why I want to recommend Monarch Money. Monarch is a top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. With Monarch, you can create custom budgets, track progress towards financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/onething. What I like about Monarch, it's intuitive. Unlike other apps that I've used in the past, it's simple. The intuitive design makes it easy to set up and customize. It allows for collaboration, so you can collaborate with your partner, family, financial advisor. It's customizable, it's customer-focused, and it's ad-free. After trying out Monarch myself, I understand why it's a top-rated personal finance app. And now, listeners of this podcast will get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/onething. That's monarchmoney.com/onething for your extended 30-day free trial.
And I manifested all these self-serving things. But what was the price I paid for that? The price was I was miserable.
I read the first book and I understood this so deeply and I could never articulate it the way you're articulating it. So I'm going to ask you, since I get to have you in person, the question I would have asked you when I read about it the first time, which is, well, then like, what are we doing all of this for? Like, we're all trying to manifest these big goals and these big dreams that we have. So how do you change this? If you're like, but I really do want the Porsche. I can pretend like I don't, but I really want it. And is that to say we shouldn't be manifesting those physical results at all, whether it's fulfillment in our work or success in business or financial success? Like, how do we reframe this for ourselves so that we're not being inauthentic?
Well, I think you just said it. You have to be authentic. And let me give you a couple examples and I'll get back further to what you just said. We know, as an example, that if you look at the research by Bob Buettner in the Blue Zones, or the work by Robert Waldinger, who heads the 85-year-old Harvard Adult Development Study, which is often called the Longevity or Happiness Study. What do we know? We know that what allows people to be their healthiest, to live longer, is actually to have a worldview where they care for others. Mm. That is what we were designed for. When that is not your worldview, there is a negative physiologic effect. Because as I mentioned, if it's all about I, that's your ego oftentimes, and it's based on a foundation oftentimes of insecurity or inauthenticity. And that has a negative physiologic effect, and it limits how your brain networks function in regard to manifesting. So that's why looking outward and saying, how can I benefit others? It actually is how you benefit yourself. And you may have heard the Dalai Lama quote that says, if you want to make others happy, be compassionate, care for them, recognize their suffering, have a desire to alleviate that suffering. But if you want to be happy, be compassionate. And the reason that is because when you care, when you are in this parasympathetic mode, if you will, all your physiologic functions work their best, but also all your brain networks. And we were talking about how do you embed your intention? I mentioned those four brain networks. what many people don't realize is we may sit there and say, you know, I want this, and there's a chance that could get into your subconscious. But what they don't realize is, you know, we get 10 million bits of information from our sensory organs every second. And, you know, 99.99% go to maintaining what we call homeostasis or body functions. But on a conscious level, we have access to 50 to 100 bits. And we can embed that portion on a conscious level into our subconscious. And the way we do that is to do something that is called value tagging. You are placing a value on what you're embedding. And what does that do? That gets or activates, if you will, your attention network and your salience network. And basically, how do you make something salient? And what I mean by that is, on a subconscious level, what many of us don't appreciate is that once an intention is embedded, it's as if you've given a bloodhound a scent to follow. And it's on an unconscious level. And in many ways, this is the origin of synchronicity and coincidence, right? Mm-hmm. Let me give you an example. If you're at a party and it's very loud and somebody says your name, you immediately turn. Why is that? Because your subconscious is highly attuned to who you identify with as an individual. So it's always listening for that, right? And I'll give you another example. I've been working on a project for the last several months. And I was at a coffee shop, and I've been thinking about this. And again, very noisy, but suddenly I heard some people talking about that, something very similar. And I went over and talked to them, and now we're working together. My point is that bloodhound is always sniffing around for opportunities to respond. Another example is, as a neurosurgeon, you know, I see a lot of people who have conditions that many would characterize as rare. But as an example, I had a patient who had hydrocephalus or water on the brain. And they say, oh, my goodness, I've never heard of that before. And then I see them 2 months later and they go, it's the most amazing thing. I've seen five people with the, right? Yeah. It's like if you're thinking of, you know, I'd really like to have this car, but there are not many around. And suddenly there are 10 of them that you see.
Yeah, you see them everywhere.
Yeah, because you're attuned to it. You've been able to embed that. And that's what the goal of this book is to teach you how to embed your intention in the way which is most likely to make those manifest. Now, I have to give you a caveat, though. There is no timeline on this. It's not as if 3 weeks from now, I expect to have X, right? And there are other factors that may influence. And in fact, there may be things that you're not aware of that if, in fact, you do manifest, it could have negative consequences. Or what you manifest actually isn't what, or what you wish to manifest actually isn't what you really need, if you will. And it changes. As an example, we were talking about Porsches.
We have a theme, James. I just have to tell you, in alignment with all of this, we interviewed a couple weeks ago, interviewed Guy Kawasaki, and we must have spent like 15 minutes on Porsches. So our audience is getting a true manifestation of that conversation in this. Like, we have a theme going right now.
Well, that's funny you say that, because I'm supposed to talk to him shortly.
Oh, wow. That's so funny.
But anyway, getting back
to Porsche with him. You'll get him on the runway.
But anyway, I bought a Porsche a long time ago, several years ago. And now I will preface this, but I've had several Porsches, so I am not anti-materialistic. But anyway, I sold it. And actually, after I sold it, I really regretted it. And I've thought about it ever since then. And I was going, God, I wish I hadn't sold. I've had one Porsche in between. And I go, I still really miss that Porsche. And so I embedded that. Now, and what happened was about 3 weeks ago, actually, my oldest son, who's 20, I don't know how he did it, but he said, you know, I was just looking up the VIN number of our old car, and it's for sale.
No way.
Yes, and it turned out that the guy had bought it, and literally, he's had it for 3 years, and he only put 500 miles on it. And he decided to sell it. And he apparently he's big time collected for whatever reason. He decided to get rid of it. So I got my Porsche back.
Like the Porsche, That's so funny.
Yeah. So it, but anyway, maximizing your potential requires embedding your intention. Now, getting back to things outside of Porsches, is that you have to do certain things. And how do you do that? To make it salient, there's a saying that it, what wires together, fires together. Mm. And this is this idea that when things are repeated or there is repetition, especially based on each of your sensory organs, as an example, then that makes that embedding stronger. And so, and again, what has popularly been brought up is making a list, right? Reading the list silently, reading the list aloud, closing your eyes and visualizing you in that position. And those are the techniques to increase the likelihood of manifestation. And again, what also happens is that when you do it through the perspective, how can I be of service? It actually oftentimes changes what you think you want. And so oftentimes you may be sitting there and have this self-serving idea, but when you look through the frame of how can I be of service to others, you sit there and go, oh, well, actually, there's this other thing that I think not only will help other people, but it will also help me. And that is actually what I really want, because nothing is so lonely or isolating than being in your own world and repeatedly ruminating about what you want and need. I think the other thing that's important is you talked about goals. There's nothing wrong with a goal. In fact, that's how we succeed in life. We have goals. We want to achieve certain things. And there's nothing wrong with that. The only time that becomes a problem, though, is if you are so attached to a goal that you forget everything else that's around you. And also, when you're attached to a goal, it can lead to great, great disappointment. And so what I would suggest is, one, realizing that goals are wonderful, and they do take hard work. You know, it's not as if 10 people signed up to run the race and everybody gets an award, which was a narrative that was promulgated in our educational system for a time. It makes a lot of very entitled children. But if you work to achieve a goal, that's fantastic. The problem is, and I'm sure you've seen some quote-unquote influencers who'll say, you know, I get up at 4 a.m. and I run a marathon, and then I go to the weight room for 4 hours, and then I do this, and I'm in great shape, man. And if you don't do it, you're a loser. Right. Well, you know, that's fine for them. And I'm not going to argue about their motives. But when you're so focused on that, how do you have relationships? How do you have friends? And the journey in life isn't showing up at the end. The journey in life is being present as you're working towards those goals. And if you're so focused on that, you miss having relationships and connection to other people. The other problem is that one of the greatest causes of suffering is attachment and craving. Mm. And you have to understand that these things have to be tempered.
James, I wanted to, so something we talk a lot about goals. It's kind of the central theme in many ways.
Kind of our thing.
Yeah, it's kind of our thing. But we also, in parallel to talking about things that we want to achieve, we often are looking at, like I said, in parallel, who you are becoming and being conscious of the development of you as a person. And seems to speak more to what you're suggesting, which is like be intentional about developing like who you are and the things you focus on so that perhaps you achieve that goal, but it's really like this person that you're growing into and the surrounding impact of that as you go.
Well, let me give you two examples. As one is, we see oftentimes children who are driven by their parents to ruthlessly achieve academically, to the point where these children have a perception that their only value is a grade. And the problem with that is that if they don't attain that grade, and where I live, you know, there's a high school called Gunn High School, which is a very, very competitive high school. I mean, literally, children commit suicide if they get a B. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's that competitive sometimes. And in fact, it happened about 6 or 8 weeks ago. When your whole identity as and you're told by your parents, you have to do this, this, this. Otherwise, you're not part of the family, or you shame the family, or you're an embarrassment. It puts immense pressure on the child. But the other thing it'll can do also, and we've seen scandals like this at Stanford, Harvard, is they cheat.
Yeah.
Well, how is that making a functional, good human being? If a child is going to cheat as a high school student, if they're going to cheat as a college student, then their whole life is going to be one of cheating, because it's a zero-sum game where they have to win and someone has to lose. And this is not how to create a healthy child. The other example is in neurosurgery, you know, it's a highly competitive field. And, you know, there are individuals who, you know, they strive so hard for this, and their egos are so wrapped up in it that that's their identity. And I'm not here to say that there's anything wrong with being, you know, a neurosurgeon as an example. But if your whole identity is people saying, you're so great, you're a neurosurgeon, then it's a sad statement about you and who you think you are. Because those typically are not people you want to be around. And I'm sure you know people like this. Everywhere you go, they say, yeah. I. And you say, shut the fuck up.
Well, I think, James, this is, you see so often in all of these examples that you've just given, at some point, you got to lay this identity to rest. Like, at some point, you can no longer be a neurosurgeon. I know you are one for life, but at some point, like, you no longer have the ability to perform surgery. And I know in a past life, I used to work for the NFL, and I used to watch these players when they would retire, who had such a hard time acclimating into society as a non-professional football player, right? And I think you see this with students too. When they get out of college, then they get a little bit lost because they don't know how to achieve, because they're not getting a grade. When you go and work for a company, you're not getting graded on that. So all of a sudden, the competitive landscape changes. And I think there's countless examples of any of these where if you lose that identity, which eventually you always do, you're a little bit lost too.
Well, and this is the nature of attachment, and it causes suffering, right? You're no longer that, therefore you're nothing, and you've spent your whole life focused on that. I mean, I cannot tell you the number of neurosurgery colleagues who I have who, you know, I'm going to work, I'm the best, I have to do this, and they pay no attention to their family, their children. And so after 20 or 30 years of doing this, frankly, they've been divorced typically at least once, if not more times. I know a fellow who was divorced 5 times, and it's finally got into his head near the end of his life that he wasted his entire life by ruthlessly focusing on this. Now, on the one hand, he's an incredibly great, wonderful, well-respected neurosurgeon, but fundamentally, his life is in shambles. Well, what do you want to be? I mean, it's great to be very accomplished at something. And yes, sometimes it takes sacrifice. And if you consciously do that, that is your choice. But if you're carrying people along on that path, it can be horribly painful for them. And frankly, they don't end up typically being happy. And so how do you create a balanced life, right? Where you are able to balance and understand that, yes, I need to compete. Yes, I do want to win. But I also temper that with understanding that I have obligations, if I've chosen to get married or have children, to those people. And I think you have to be conscious of trying to have a balanced life. Now, I had somebody tell me one time, well, if you want to be a good doctor, you have to sacrifice that. I said, well, then just be single.
Yeah. Don't drag anyone down with you.
Yeah. But again, that's easier said than done for many people. And I have to admit, I am divorced once. And it was because I focused on trying to be important. and, you know, the leader of the pack, and I was never home. I mean, I worked 18 hours a day every day, and I had some false notion that, well, if they call me on Saturday and I'm not on call, that's because I'm so great and they need me. And what's so funny is when I finally said, no, I'm not on call, I'm not available, they still like me and they still refer patients to me. You know, you just can't be everywhere and everything to everyone, and you have to accept it. And you have to also realize, frankly, none of us are that important. And I am not any more important than anyone else. Yes, there are certain talents I have, and there are certain talents other people have that put them in a particular position. But it's okay. We're all human beings. And this is why it's sad to see people who have an inflated sense of self-import be rude to other people. And whether it's in a restaurant or someplace where you are expecting some level of service or cooperation or working with, and to watch people be so rude to people, especially people who, frankly, oftentimes are powerless, it's very disappointing, and it doesn't help you. And so I think having an understanding that I'm not that important, no one's that important, we're all human beings. And this is this idea of being able to look at people eye to eye, right? No one is above you, no one is below you. And I'm sure you've seen situations, though, where people look down on other people. And it is very sad and it's disappointing. And again, getting back to this being of service to others, what brightens your life, what makes it extraordinary to be a human being is to connect with others, to use whatever powers you have to help other people. And frankly, most of the time, it doesn't require too much. It could be a letter of recommendation. It could be shaking somebody's hand. It could be saying hello. It could be giving a person who's down a hug. These are simple things we can do. But every time we do that, that makes our physiology work its best. It makes us feel better. And when we're in that mode, that is the maximum way in which you can manifest your intention.
I think this goes back to, James, to what I'm going to bring back what you said at the very beginning of this conversation, which is you were hypercritical of other people, but mostly because you were hypercritical of yourself when you were younger. And I think ultimately, not only are people our mirror, i.e. we usually aren't hypercritical of others unless that's what's happening in our own head. And we usually aren't unkind to others unless that's what's happening in our own head. And then I imagine the broader conversation is that the world then becomes our mirror, like our entire world then becomes a manifestation of what's happening inside of us. I mean, tell me if I'm not tracking with this, but that's what I hear when you say it that way.
No, I think that's exactly right. And that's in some ways part of the woes of our world. People get so involved in their egos, and we can only look at our present U.S. society. You know, we have insecure people who make false narratives, and then they use that to turn suffering people against other people. And it's a horrible thing to watch because it does no one any good. And then what it does also is it diverts attention actually from the real culprit. And I don't want to get into a political diatribe here but in many ways, this has to do with ever increasing income inequality, the haves and the have nots, versus generosity, which allows everyone to live a life where they have shelter, they have food, their children are taken care of. And seemingly, we keep decreasing the social safety net to the benefit of others who already have plenty.
Have you found that either from a neurological perspective or just external observation that groups of people, when working together with a manifesting mindset that's dialed in a way that you think is maximizing, that there's a net greater impact on each other? Like there's an exponent of influence. Like I think about, you mentioned the Blue Zones before and how that community is reciprocal. And I think of like teams perhaps, but if you do this together and even if you're not aligned on the same manifestation, just have this practice, is there an exponential benefit to that?
Well, I think yes. I think it's more than one plus one, actually. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to note because in the book, I also talk about oscillation and vibration, which you hear a lot in the woo-woo pseudoscience world. But and it's interesting because what happens oftentimes in that world is there's a little piece of truth or science that's validated, then they wrap it in all this dogma for the benefit of their defined constituency. And now, I hate to say it, but that's also like religion, right? The basis of every religion is compassion. And if you want to call it the, what is it? The, shoot, I can't remember it, but I will. But anyway, and this has been known for thousands of years. And the reason compassion is so important in this religion is because it has so much benefit to you. And it's been recognized through experiential knowledge, but in each culture, that's wrapped around a narrative that supports that. And oftentimes that's a narrative religion because that pulls people together in these different environments. And but the same is true in some of these other areas like manifestation. There is some truth in what is told, but there is an underlying neuroscientific basis for why this is the case. And it's as we were talking about earlier.
I'd love to understand, as you think about this idea of manifesting either for yourself or on a group level, if you start someone at the very beginning of this, like what are the basic things? If someone says, I've tried this before, it doesn't work for me, like what are the things that you usually find are the blockers that are getting in the way? Other than perhaps that we're trying to manifest outside of ourselves, that's purely for ourselves. Other than that, what are the things that usually get in people's way of being able to actually bring these things to fruition?
Sure. Well, one is you just mentioned people get in their own way because they're doing it incorrectly and it's self-serving. And so the likelihood of occurring is lower. But other examples are people don't understand that oftentimes they give their self-agency away. And I think Chris sort of alluded to that. If you're waiting for something outside yourself, you're defining yourself as being powerless. Yet the reality is we have immense power within us. And this is the nature of belief. Belief is extraordinarily, extraordinarily powerful. Now, it's not going to make you be able to defy gravity or the laws of physics. But that being said, it can have a profound, profound effect. So you have to understand within you, when you recognize that power, that is something that is always there for you. You just have to accept that truth. And we see it every day. And you can even use other examples of how people, through potentially other techniques, but very similar, such as hypnosis. You can bypass everything with hypnosis. Or what we see with the placebo effect. Or we can look at people, as an example, like Wim Hof, or Tibetan monks who can control their heart rate, their body temperature through mental practice. So if you don't understand how the mental practice works, then you can't do it. The other problem, and one which I have had, is as an example, I say, I want to lose weight. Well, I go, okay, I'm in 1 month, I'm going to lose 60 pounds. Well, that's insane. But people sort of want, I want it now, and I'm going to, and you wake up and you go, I'm going to do this today. And then you do it for a day or two and go, oh, I can't do it because you're trying to do too much.
Yeah.
And
I was just about to say, but if you title a book, Manifest 60 Pounds of Weight Loss in a Month, then you're going to be a bestseller.
That's the next book. but then I'll be sued for lying. But anyway, yeah. Or I'll be sued because people will do it and they'll like tie themselves in like, you know, on a post out in the middle of nowhere and there's no food or water.
No food or water anywhere.
Yeah, I lost 60 pounds, but I died. But anyway, now I've lost my complete train of thought.
Sorry.
But let's see, what were we talking about before?
Where you were going, I think, with it was that you were talking about creating realistic manifestations.
And goals, right. As an example, I was on a conversation with BJ Fogg, who wrote a book called, I think, Tiny Habits, but there's also one called Atomic Habits. But the way we make long-lasting behavioral change, which in some ways what we're talking about, is you have to do baby steps. And so one of the things you can do, because a lot of people go, well, I don't understand how to manifest. Well, what you're trying to understand is how do I get control of my mind to make things happen? And when you do these tiny habits, you're demonstrating to yourself it can be done, and then that strengthens your belief system, and you build up and up and up. As an example, again, I used to say, okay, I'm going to get into shape. I'm going to walk 10 miles today. And then I get to the end of my block and I go, oh, I can't. So if you wake up and you, let's say, go a half a block, you go, that's fine. That's okay for today. I did it. I showed up. I did it. I put the effort forward. Then that's how you do it. And each day you increase a little bit. And this is the other aspect of this, is that it's not a one and done. It's not like, okay, I'm going to manifest today. Thank you. Okay, I'm done. Why didn't happen? There's a problem here. You know, getting back to the statement in some ways about the universe, just to throw in God here, there's a quote that says, God only helps those who help themselves. Now, I'm not a believer in God per se, but I think that statement is true. You have to do work if you're going to manifest these things. It's not like you sit back in your easy chair and go, okay, I want to run a marathon and I'm just going to sit here day after day. Now, what is interesting about that is that research has shown that the brain cannot distinguish between thought and actually reality. And what I mean by that is there's evidence that if you think about building your muscles, they will actually increase in size simply from thinking about it. But this is the power that you have within yourself to manifest. But again, I would say, don't be too hard on yourself. Also, understanding what has gotten you where you're at today. And what I mean by that is so many people carry baggage from their childhoods. And that baggage determines every relationship, every interaction. And this is why you see individuals who pick the same partner over and over. Geez, I don't understand why my third husband is abusive to me or wife.
Right? How do I keep choosing these people?
Yeah, well, it's because you have this baggage that you haven't understood that is the driver. And that is extremely powerful, because these processes which you grew up with get embedded within you and they stick to you. So until you're able to sit down and write a narrative of how did I get here? What have I done? What are the things that keep happening to me? And then you sit there and say, oh, I understand. My father repeatedly was abusive to me, and he always hugged me afterwards. And that's why I associate abuse with love, right? And yeah. When you can disengage that, when you can get those insights, that liberates you. And, you know, also just to throw out there, I can tell you, and I think part of it's in my first book, but, you know, I ended up being extremely successful. With the dot-com crash, I lost close to $80 million. Now, of course, when that happens, you get two best friends. One is the banker, because I borrowed $15 million and I didn't have a way to pay. And the other was your lawyer, who theoretically keeps your stuff together. Long story short, I was in the hole $3 million. And I went through this period of self-reflection. Like, how did I get here? What did I miss? That because Ruth actually gave me the answers, but I was 12 and didn't process it or have the self-awareness. And when I went back and reflected, I saw that I went from rags to riches, which if you're poor, that is an incredible driver to quote unquote succeed, but it's not really succeeding because you're trying to fill an emptiness you have. That emptiness can only be filled by caring for others or being of service. It's not from me getting another Porsche. Not that there's anything wrong.
Well, I think that goes back to that the world and people are your mirror. I mean, you would you agree that eventually you manifested emptiness because you were still there? Like you had not found fulfillment outside of the stuff.
Yeah, and I had not sat down and really analyzed it. I thought my purpose was to do what I did. That was success. So what happened is once I lost everything, so I went from rags to riches to rags, I went through this period of deep reflection. And the interesting thing about it was I had made some donations of stock to charity, but here I am broke, $3 million in the hole. I owe the bank $15 million. Now, I ended up selling everything except my Porsche. But anyway.
He's throwing cars.
Yeah. But anyway, I sold everything, and I was able to pay all the money back, but I still have $3 million in the hole. But my lawyer said to me, said, you know, Jim, you had asked us to set up these charitable donations, but we actually never filed the paperwork. If you want, we can, it goes away and you keep the stock. But through this period of reflection and what I had experienced and a realization that the poverty that I had experienced was like a monkey on my back driving me, I told the lawyer to go ahead and give that stock away. Now, that ended up being worth $30 million. but what did it do? It was extraordinary because it changed how I looked at the world. It was no longer about me. It was being of service. It allowed me to create a center, as an example, at Stanford that's focused on compassion, empathy, and altruism, of which His Holiness the Dalai Lama is the founding benefactor. This led to he and I becoming friends. It led to me becoming the chairman of the Dalai Lama Foundation. And it then led to me becoming friends with Desmond Tutu, Thich Nhat Hanh, Amma the Hugging Saint, Sri Sri Ravi Shankar, Eckhart Tolle, Byron Katie, and a whole host of other extraordinary spiritual and religious leaders in this world. And it enriched my life beyond anything I can tell you. So in some ways, I did go back from rags to riches. Now, I just want to emphasize, even though I lost, quote unquote, everything, I was still a neurosurgeon. So I still had an income that was more than 99.9% of people. So I was not living in my car. I was not suffering in that manner. So I don't want anyone to feel sorry for me, because even having lost everything, I was extraordinarily blessed and very fortunate.
I remember that story from Into the Magic Shop, and I remember you sharing the pivotal moment of you still choosing to donate the money. And I remember sitting in, I have a little reading chair that I still have from my early days. And I remember sitting in my reading chair and being like, this guy's nuts. I would, I want to tell you that I am evolved enough, James, that I would have followed your lead. And I could not wholeheartedly tell you that with a straight face. Well, and I respect you all the more for it.
Well, you know, what's funny about that is I had just begun dating my present wife. So it's now been 20 some years. And the Wall Street Journal was doing a story about this. So they interviewed actually the woman I was dating at the time. And she said, well, what do you think about that? She says, well, I don't mind Jim being generous. I just wish he hadn't given it all away. but giving it all away makes a great story.
Yes, it does. Well, James, I wish we could keep you here forever. I mean, this has been a dream of mine. I remember reading your first book, like I shared with you at the beginning, and this has just been such a privilege to get to talk with you. And I don't want to miss our chance to end this the way that we end every podcast, which is asking, what's the one thing that you would want our listeners to take away from this conversation?
Well, I said I would say three things.
And you were going to break the rules.
As usual. And that actually is success, breaking the rule. But
well, you find out there are none. They're not even real.
There you have it. You have answered that question. So don't everyone break the rules, according to Nikki. Do not blame me, though. But I think there are three things. One is to try to understand to the best of your ability what are driving your behaviors. Two, understand that being of service to others is the greatest benefit you can give to yourself. And three, to remember that every day, no matter our circumstance, has the ability to improve the life of at least one other person.
So beautiful. Thank you for that. I'm going to encourage everyone to pick up the new book, Mind Magic. From me, please also pick up Into the Magic Shop. Like I said, it's not flippant when I say it truly changed my life. And I'm so excited to read this one as well. And thank you so much for being here with us today. We would love to have you back. And thank you all for listening.
Thanks, well, James. I'll be happy to come back. We can make the whole show about Porsches if you want.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to put you and Guy on here, and y'all are going to like have it out about cars. I'm going to warn everybody ahead of time that it's going to be a Porsche off between you and Guy, and I'll let you guys just run the podcast yourselves.
Be careful what you ask.
I would love it.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you, guys. It's really been a joy and a pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, James.
Likewise, James. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the One Thing Podcast. If you're a bold risk taker who wants to dream big and achieve a higher level of success in your life or business, visit theonething.com. There you'll find information on one-on-one coaching, our exclusive community membership program, and customized workshops that will help you get your team or organization aligned and rowing in the same direction. That's the1.com to start living the life you've always dreamed of today. Be sure to follow the show to stay up to date on weekly episodes, guest interviews, and more. Plus, we would love to hear from you. Send us a voice note by going to speakpipe.com/theonething or email us at podcast@theonething.com. We'll see you next week.